Welcome to the Iditarod, a podcast about what else? The Iditarod, a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM Radio in Nome. I'm your host, Josh Edge. Nicholas Petit led mushers into Tanana last night. Now he and the other race leaders are making their way along the Yukon River toward Ruby. But before we jump into today's episode, here's a quick word from our sponsor.
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 40 years of fueling the 49th state, is proud to support Iditarod coverage on Alaska Public Media.
As I mentioned earlier, Nicholas Petit was the first musher to Tanana and won the first musher to the Yukon Award. That means he got to take a little break, eat a tasty-sounding five-course meal, and he also got $3,500, a commemorative Alaska gold pan, and an expensive bottle of champagne. Next stop for he and the rest of the race leaders is Ruby, then they'll make their way up to Galena, then swing north to Hooslia after that. Just a reminder, we are in the midst of producing our daily episodes, which we'll keep on keeping on until the end of the race. You can subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher, or listen on alaskapublic.org. If you listened to our episode yesterday, you probably know that our trail reporters, Ben Matheson with KNOM Radio in Nome, and Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes are, well, out on the trail and are no doubt curled up in their sleeping bags after a long night of reporting and admiring the northern lights and, I'm sure, chowing down on what has to be some delicious freeze-dried food. But luckily, it looks like they sent me some stuff overnight, so let's see what we've got. All right, so as we know, mushers have started to reach Tanana. That means teams are ready to launch their race plans as the 8-hour and 24-hour rest periods come into play. But first, they're going to have to run the longest stretch of the race between checkpoints and make it through the early race with their teams intact. That's according to Ben, at least.
As the sun went down Tuesday, Nicholas Petit staked his claim as the first musher to the Yukon River. He receives $3,500 in ones and a five-course meal prepared by the chefs at the Lakefront Hotel. But first, he needed to find a guest. Martin Boozer, the musher who arrived 36 minutes after him, was not up for it.
Yukon River dinner? Yeah.
Oh, you're welcome to join me. Otherwise, I got to find someone else.
No, find somebody else. I got to go sleep.
Okay.
I don't like all those...
Tanana Mayor Donald Folger presented Petit with gifts from the community and ultimately found him a date.
You guys arm wrestle for it, huh?
Take the other elder, Blanche. Blanche, would you eat with him for me?
Yeah.
Yay, thank you! Yay, Blanche!
Tanana resident Blanche Edwin joined Petit for the gourmet meal as cameras clicked. Andrew Adelsberger, the food and beverage director at the Lakefront Hotel, described the salad course.
Our sun-dried cranberry, pear, and gorgonzola salad on fresh springs, and it's topped with a raspberry lime dressing that Bobby made in-house.
Petit's team, however, ate a less leafy meal in the dog yard at 25 below.
Chicken fat and chicken skins and beef stripe and kibble.
Yep.
No ribeye steaks. I've done that before and it backfired.
While Petit celebrated, several teams pulled into Tanana. Jason Mackey arrived fourth, right behind Mitch Seavey.
I had no idea. There was only three teams here in front of me. I had no clue. I don't know where everybody's at. Well, I did see a bunch of teams parked, but...
Dozens of teams Tuesday afternoon pulled off to the side of the trail and rested in the midday sun before reaching Tanana. While the forecast is calling for mellower temperatures, Iditarod Chief Veterinarian Stuart Nelson and his volunteers are paying close attention to the athlete's body condition over the course of another frigid Alaska night.
Very few drop dogs, so, you know, that's not been an issue at this point in time. It's been very, very low numbers. You know, overall, the dogs are healthy, been really good that way. It's just with these cold temps, we want to really monitor the hydration and body weights real closely. But they're pretty perky and peppy.
Upon reaching the Yukon, mushers' mandatory rest strategies are on the horizon. Teams can now take their 8-hour rest at checkpoints between here and Kaltag, in addition to their 24-hour layover. Mackey wants to get hundreds of more miles behind him before taking the big rest.
I'm set up for my 24 starting in Galena, in Hooslia, Koyukuk, and Nulato. If I could get all the way to Nulato, that would be the best, I think. The further you can go for the 24, the better off. There is a slew of teams here that are thinking the same way. And, I mean, I can hear them pulling in now, man. They're screaming.
Before many teams take their eight-hour break, they'll head west on the Yukon River to Ruby in the longest stretch between checkpoints at close to 120 miles. Petit's plan is to have options with the gear and supplies that he packs.
I plan on loading up my sled with anything I might need. You see, I still have straw. I still had a bunch of food. I don't make a plan because I don't know what the trail's going to do. I don't know what the weather's going to do. And I don't know what my dogs are going to do. I just leave equipped for anything.
For Wade Mars, the fifth musher into the checkpoint, the next couple runs to Ruby will determine how quickly he needs to bank the big rest.
If the dog team does really good going across here, then we'll just take an 8 and keep on going. If they don't do very good, then we'll take a 24 when we get to the other end of this run and then go from there. So,
25 minutes behind Mars was Bethel musher Pete Kaiser.
I'd prefer to take my 24 first, so we'll see how it goes, though. It kind of all just depends on what the dogs need at any given time, so it's nice to have the option of either of them from now on. So, but I don't think we'll need to take either of them here.
Mushers will drive their teams west early Wednesday with both options at hand and hard choices to make. For KNOM News, I'm Ben Matheson in Tanana.
So at the beginning of that story, we heard very briefly from Martin Boozer. He politely declined Nicholas Petit's invitation to the Yukon River dinner. He had a rather rough go of it last year at the Iditarod. Here's a segment of an interview Zach got with Martin last year that pretty much sums up his 2016 race.
They astutely diagnosed it as a deep bone bruise and bleeding and all that stuff, but you won't see anything until it starts showing, coming through the skin. But then by then, I hopefully will be a gnome.
For more from that particular interview, you can check out episode 3 of the podcast. You'll hear more from Martin and the rest of the drama that played out during last year's race. Anyways, Zach was able to catch up with Martin prior to this year's race to check in.
First of all, the last time I saw you, your knee, you'd fallen off your sled, an old woman, and were in Unalakleet. So how's your knee?
Well, that was actually, it ended up being a pretty well-torn hamstring. It was very, very painful. And by the time I got to know him, it was as big a bruise as I have ever seen. It took almost a whole year to heal up, and it's good now.
In addition to the injury last year, Boozer was also a little bit preoccupied. His son Nikolai was in a really bad car accident a few weeks before the 2016 race and was receiving treatment in Seattle. But he's well enough now that Martin jokes he can start looking for a job.
We joke that this might be the first year in 28 years when I don't have to worry about the children, you know. So this is going to be about just the dogs and myself.
And now Boozer sounds almost excited as he explains his plans to rest along the longer legs of the early trail this year. Even with those overnight temperatures forecast to get down below 30 degrees below zero.
I'll be camping a lot. I'll bring my tent again. I have a tiny little lightweight tent that I incorporated in my gear, and I'll be totally self-contained and very, very happy to be that. Privacy, comfort, and you're totally independent of the checkpoints by doing that.
Boozer ran his first Iditarod back in 1980, and he says his goal this year remains the same as ever, to get to know him as quickly as possible. Switching gears a little bit, in many, many ways, the Iditarod and Yukon Quest are really different races. But when the Iditarod starts from Fairbanks, there are definitely some similarities, particularly the temperature and the long river miles. Several mushers who ran in this year's Quest are also making a break for Nome. Ben was able to catch up with a couple of them before they left the starting line in Fairbanks earlier this week.
Catherine Keith, you just finished the Yukon Quest as Rookie of the Year. How did that team deliver that performance for you, and how much of that team is with today?
I was really proud of the dogs. I thought they did a fantastic job on the Quest, coming from out in Kotzebue with not many hills to go to the Quest and really learn how to climb hills. I thought it was a great performance, and 11 of the 14 dogs from the Quest are in my Iditarod team, so I'm really excited to see how that training really pays off in this race as well.
Mm-hmm. And you got a chance to spend a lot of time on the Yukon, a lot of time on rivers, and you know, does that translate to this race?
Oh, yeah, I think it's going to. I mean, it's really exciting to say we're going to go from Whitehorse all the way to Nome in 1 year, kind of traveling all along the Yukon. And the dogs are great at this low temperature. You know, they love, 20 below, 40 below. They can take it. They're tough, tough Arctic dogs. And we got a lot of experience on the quest with that. And so we feel really comfortable in this race.
Ben was also able to catch up with an Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran, Hugh Neff.
You know, you spent a lot of your career running the Quest and Iditarod as well.
Mm-hmm.
What's the most basic comparison between these river miles and, you know, a 1,000 miles of Quest river miles?
Well, the Quest is much more difficult for many reasons. First of all, jumble ice, number one. Second of all, less traffic. The Iditarod is more difficult because of all the people you have to deal with. Nothing against humans, but I came up to Alaska to be a dog and not hang out with a bunch of people in the woods. So for me, it is quite difficult to do this race just because I'm so used to doing the Quest and being by myself for the whole race, you know. So to have to be around people all the time, sort of, it's a little bit tougher than people would realize. But the big difference is not the river, it's the coast. And that is what separates these two races. I mean, the Quest can be brutal, you know, 40, 50 below. But, man, there's nothing like the coast of Alaska to really let you know how small of a human you are. I've been through it. You guys know what happened to me a few years back. So you really have to be prepared for it. And, you know, just take care of the dogs. Don't be in a hurry. This year, you know, it's going to be just a survival course getting a Ruby, it sounds like it. From all my friends that have been messaging me from Tanana and Manly and whereabouts, sounds like there ain't much of a trail. Yeah, but, you know, it's a, I think talking with Cody and Alan, you know, this trail's a little bit set up for the Quest mushers just because our dogs are a little bit more dialed into conditions. But we haven't seen this type of deep snow yet, so who knows?
How do you think about some of these big runs with, you know, 90 miles from Nenana to Manly and, you know, 120 when you're going towards Ruby?
You know, I'm known to be one of the guys who can do these longer runs, but you don't necessarily want to be doing that too often this early into the race. So I've had many people from all over the world sending me messages going, Hugh, chill out, take it easy. And hopefully I can learn to do that this year. We've got a nice veteran team, and if I can man up and just learn to camp out a little bit more and not always be worried about getting to the next checkpoint, I think we'll do a little bit better this year.
So, obviously, there are tons of differences between the Yukon Quest and the Iditarod, but there are at least a couple similarities, namely the conditions. Now, toward the end of that clip, Hugh mentioned a nice veteran team. And while some mushers may choose to bring a team full of mostly younger dogs, might not have as many races or miles under their belts or harnesses, rather, he takes a little different approach.
I've got a dog named Mojito, and then I've got George Costanza as my other leader. George is a 9-year-old. This will be his 10,000 miler. Mojito, I think this is his 8th or 9th. He's 7. I'm a big believer in trying to promote not winning dogs, but winning lives of dogs. And I think we've been doing it the last few years. We've been proving that older dogs up until 9-10 years old can still perform at a consistent level. My oldest to race was actually a 12-year-old named June Marie. And then my boy Walter, he's retired now, but he did 13,000 milers. Alan and Allie have a dog named Keto, very famous dog. He did 14. I mean, so people think 1,000 miles is a long way, but if this is your lifestyle, it's just another day in the park.
And although he doesn't take it to quite the same level as Hugh Neff, Martin Boozer also leans toward a little more experienced of a team.
Tell me about your team. Is it a lot of younger dogs, or are these seasoned veterans that you're bringing?
It's a very seasoned team of experienced dogs, between 1 Iditarod experience and 6 or 7. So it's a nice taper, a nice stagger between oldest being 7.5 and youngest being 2.5. Well-balanced team.
Are you camping on some of the longer runs on this route, or are you going to be out on the trail?
Absolutely. I'll be camping a lot. I'll bring my tent again. I have a tiny little lightweight tent that I incorporated in my gear, and I'll be totally self-contained and very, very happy to be that.
Sticking with dogs, a listener and a public radio colleague sent us a rather interesting question. So let's take a listen.
Hi, this is Emily in Sitka, And I've always wanted to know about dog-musher communication. So do the mushers have different styles of directing the sled dog team? Do the sled dogs speak different languages? Like, what if there's a sled dog born in Russia or Germany, reared in Czechoslovakia? Like, I don't know where these dogs come from. What are some of the common physical gestures to get your sled dog team to veer left and right? And I'm also really interested in how trust is built between the musher and the sled dog team. What do you do if there's a rogue dog who suddenly isn't listening? What are some of the mechanisms of, like, classroom discipline that take place on the race course? I guess these are all, like, I guess all these questions have to do with people-animal relationships. Hopefully they're not too weird. And thank you so much for posing them to some of the Iditarod mushers. I look forward to listening. Thank you.
I sent this one up to Zach to get his take on the inquiry, and this is what he had to say about it.
This is quite a multi-part question. I'm going to try and handle a couple of these, but honestly, everything that Emily laid out in this question could fill books about how to handle dogs, how to build trust, how to become just a better musher and be in a better relationship with your team. As for some of the more basic stuff, the commands for left and right are G and haw. That gets your dogs to tilt one way or the other. Sharp turns with a 16-dog line are pretty much hard to impossible. I've also heard the command on by, which means focus, and gets the dogs to kind of recenter on the trail ahead if they're distracted by something to the side. Mushers work really hard to get focused teams. They have leaders at the front of their strings oftentimes who are really good about keeping the whole team on point, running, knowing where to go. A lot of what are called the team dogs, and that's pretty much everybody behind the leaders up until the very end, their job is really to just pull and take direction. Then at the very back, you've got wheel dogs, and their job is to pull. Building trust with the dogs, that's something that takes time. A lot of these mushers have had these animals since they were puppies. They got them first harnessed, they taught them how to pull on a line, they've built in run and rest expectations, they've fed them, cleaned up after them. It's just a continual bond building, and the dogs are trained in what to expect. They know if they push hard, they'll get a rest and get somebody that's letting them know they did the right thing. I'd say just as often it's the musher that disappoints the team. A lot of the times in races, you'll hear reporters like me say something like, the dogs protested, or the dogs just came to a full stop. How I understand it is that that's the dog saying, hey, you broke the expectations. We're not going to go for you right now. We need a rest, or you're not listening to us. That's kind of how the dogs communicate. Hey, we're not on board with this. I would say the relationship is a lot less like a teacher in front of an unruly classroom full of school kids, and a lot more like a coach with a team of athletes at her or his disposal. You know, the coach isn't on the court necessarily, and a musher's not hooked up to the gang line, pulling with all his or her might. But they're right there with him, making a lot of the decisions and hopefully participating in a slightly augmented way.
And speaking of mushers not quite being on gang lines, and but still being right there with the team with them throughout the whole race, we got another question from another public radio colleague who may also have the same first name and hail from the same place, but I promise they are different people. She's got a question that pertains precisely to that topic.
Hey guys, it's Emily here in Sitka. I'm a fan of the pod. My question is about fitness. So obviously the dogs run the 1,000 miles to Nome, but I'm curious about how much mushers run. I've seen some running beside their sleds or using ski poles, but are there some mushers that are known to run more than others? And how does that play into a musher's strategy? All right, thanks.
This was actually a really interesting question to me as well. And frankly, I had no idea what the answer was. So again, I send it up to Zach because apparently he is the guy with all the answers.
Great question. There's a lot of variability between mushers about how much they run or how often or how strenuously. And some mushers just sit. This year, Jeff King has essentially lawn chair attached to his sled so that he can just sit down, kind of cradles him, can tuck himself into his Arctic Moo-Moo and have a rest when he needs to. He says running, expending a bunch of calories, getting all worked up and hot, not worth it. Steals away energy you could better apply towards making decisions. Other mushers do exactly like what Emily mentioned. They run next to the sled. They use their ski poles. Some you'll see kicking like big pendulums with one leg. And there's a couple points to all this. For one thing, it keeps the mushers warm. They get a little bit of cardio aerobic exercise. They're moving, they're pumping blood when sometimes, you know, it's quite cold out there. Another is that it gives a little bit of extra momentum to the sled. It puts a little bit more effort, and some people will say, you know, every little bit helps. When you see mushers running, that could say a couple things. First of all, when you get to hills, it's just helping the team. It's getting off, it's lightening the load, it's running beside them, and it's just making the journey up a little bit easier. Some mushers are known for this. Dallas Seavey, I think at one point, packed a spare pair of running shoes. That was detail that got a lot of attention during different races. I've also heard it said that it lets the team know that you're invested too, that you're working with them, that it signals to the dogs that, you know, running isn't their job alone, that the musher's right there with them, giving them their all. So a lot of variability.
Those questions did come from our listeners. If you have a question about the race, please send it our way. You can email them to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. Better yet, record yourself on a smartphone and email us. You can use a voice recorder or memo app. Almost all phones have these. Introduce yourself, tell us where you're from, and ask away. And just in case you haven't heard from Zach enough this episode, let's be honest, can you ever really hear enough from that guy? We've got one more thing for you today. Now, we've mentioned before a couple times that when we produce stories for radio, like the one you heard from Ben in the beginning of this episode, a lot of material gets left on the digital cutting room floor. But because this is a podcast, we can take up as much time as we want. No, need to. As much time as we need to. And since we've got all that time, Zach sent in another short piece. It's kind of like a reporter's notebook if this were a newspaper, but the notebook in this case is a microphone and recorder.
So I'm sitting in the rental car right now, outside of the place where I'm staying in Fairbanks. And one of the things that surprised me last year on the Iditarod Trail was how many different places I had to go to do what we in radio call tracking. Tracking is this part of radio production for news stories where you basically, you've done all your reporting, you've done your writing, hopefully you've gotten an edit, and then you duck away somewhere quiet to talk alone into a microphone and make it sound really, really casual and natural. Almost like you were standing in the middle of a dog lot just talking while a whole scene unfolded. A dirty little secret is that we work really, really hard again and again and again and again and again to make it sound like that. Last year, I tracked outside a lot, sometimes speaking into big piles of snow that would absorb all the sound, sometimes out in the middle of a kind of wooded forest tree lot area to get away from the sounds of dogs barking. But outside right now, it's about 21, 23 below zero, and for me, that's just a little bit too cold. Thankfully, the car's warmed up just enough that in my giant coat, I can sit here without shivering. But if it warms up another 10 to 15 degrees in the next couple days, I'll probably be back outside. Plus, I won't have a rental car. So taking advantage of these lavish circumstances to send in this reporter's notebook. Talking into a microphone in Fairbanks, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
And that makes me even more thankful to be talking into a microphone by myself in a nice, warm studio in Anchorage. Sorry, Zach. I guess it just takes some people a little more work than others to make it sound so casual. Now, I would say that's all the time we have for today. I guess I should amend that, though, and say that's all the time we are choosing to take today. Thanks to Zachariah Hughes from Alaska Public Media and to KNOM Radio's Ben Matheson for all their help this morning. We are in the midst of our daily episodes, so if you like what you hear, you can tune in every day during the race. To make that a little bit easier, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher, or listen on alaskapublic.org. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras, and I'm Josh Edge. Goodbye.
My buddy is in, I think he's like in maybe Elam now or White Mountain, a guy named Jeff Oatley. He's biking the trail right now. And that guy's really impressive. You know, he's biking all the way from Skagway to Nome. And that's, makes you realize, you know, we think we're tough, but we're just hanging out with our dogs. He's doing it all by himself.